Iran is warning the U.S. about the recent flights of its B-52 bombers over the Persian Gulf. It says Tehran won't shy from crushing aggressors. A top U.S. general says law enforcement agencies are screening National Guard troops deployed to secure the presidential inauguration amid fears of an insider attack. And also in the headlines, Russia hitting back at Western countries' condemnation of the arrest of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. It says they want to distract their citizens from domestic problems. Good to have you with us. Starting with a warning by Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. He's warning the U.S. about the recent flights of B-52 bombers over the Persian Gulf. In a tweet, the foreign minister said that if those flights are meant to intimidate Iran, the Islamic Republic will not, quote, shy from crushing aggressors. He was reacting to an announcement by the U.S. Central Command that B-52 bombers had their second flight over the region this year. Now, this is the fifth time in recent months that a U.S. Air Force has flown similar missions over the region amid rising tensions between Tehran and Washington. From Israel, I'm now joined by John Stepling, author and commentator. John, good to have you with us. How do you look at this? I mean, why is the U.S. doing this?
I think there's two ways to look at it, probably. This is the final few acts of Mike Pompeo before he is no longer in office, and Trump, although I don't think Trump has much to do with these sorts of foreign policy decisions. This is the Pentagon and Pompeo. As somebody said the other day, Pompeo has left no bridge unburned as he leaves office. But, you know, when they made the first flight, the B-52s took off from North Dakota. They flew over the Atlantic, over the Eastern Mediterranean, then over Jordan and over Israel. It was a 30-hour flight, I think, all told, and then back to North Dakota. That was just an act of a symbolic warning or something, and they continue to do that. And I think the effect is diminishing each time they do it. That is assuming we understand what the effect was supposed to be in the first place. But this has been kind of typical of the Trump presidency. There's a kind of tone deaf and haphazard system of both propaganda and actual policy decisions. And this is another example. I don't know what it's meant to, you know, it's the year anniversary of Soleimani's extra legal assassination. And so they want to, I don't know, you know, sort of reinforce their authority, at least in terms of global perception.
But John, if you remember the year before that, we had this U.S. drone approaching the Iranian water borders from the Persian Gulf and the Sea, and the IRGC forces shot that down. So isn't that warning enough for the U.S. that Iran is on no joking terms when it comes to its national security?
Well, one would think so, you know, but again, I was about to say that these gestures, this sort of saber rattling that the U.S. is engaged in, feels extraordinarily toothless and almost silly at this point. I mean, Trump is kind of no longer in office, and Pompeo is soon to be, in a matter of days, no longer in office. So what exactly is going on? It's a really good question, and how much was this just the Pentagon? That's a good question. But yeah, I think globally the perception is that the U.S. is flailing about wildly without any sort of coherent design or intention. And as I've said all along, you know, the basis for these threats, the basis, because I was just reading, I think Forbes had an article about this, and they said, well, the message is to Iran, don't build nuclear weapons. This is always the question. Who decides that? Who makes this decision? That it's okay for Israel, it's okay for China, the United States, Russia, you know, all of these countries to have nuclear weapons, but it's not okay for Iran, because right now Iran is the designated villain du jour. You know, they are today's villain, and anything to do with Iran is going to be seen as somehow nefarious and threatening. And of course, it's nothing of the sort. And Iran has upheld its end of the JCPOA when that was still in place. They have done nothing but comply with the UN requests, with everybody's requests, and they've done it with dignity and restraint. I mean, in the face of multiple provocations, and yet those provocations continue. They achieve nothing, but then I suppose the U.S. has to do something with that $4 billion a day they spend on defense, and I guess this is what they're choosing to do right now.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining me from Indira. Now, the Iranian army will kick off exercises on Makran, a coastal region of the country's Balochistan province, on Tuesday. And that announcement was made by Brigadier General Kumar Saidari, the commander of the ground force. He said that the drills will involve airborne brigades, special forces, and rapid response teams. The features of the exercise are unique since the army has gone through major structural changes in accordance with the order of the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Haidari noted that this will be the first offensive and target-oriented drills in which the army will display creative tactics using indigenously made weapons. The maneuvers follow drills by the Iranian Navy in the country's strategic southern waters, as well as massive military exercises by the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps in central Iran. In other news, the U.S. law enforcement agencies are screening National Guard troops involved in the securing the presidential inauguration ceremony, and this is amid fears of an insider attack. The Chief of National Guard Bureau says the Secret Service and FBI are screening all the 25,000 National Guard troops as they arrive in Washington, D.C. Defense officials are concerned about a potential attack from service members deployed to Washington during the president-elect's inauguration. They've taken unprecedented security measures, locking down much of the Capitol ahead of the ceremony on January 8th. And that after revelations that some of those involved in the January 6th deadly attack on Congress were members of the military. Small groups of protesters gathering outside of state capitals across the United States amid heightened tensions ahead of the inauguration ceremony. Most of those in the gatherings were armed protesters. More than a dozen states have activated National Guard troops to help secure their Capitol buildings. And this after an FBI warning of armed demonstrations ahead of Joe Biden's inauguration. Experts warning that right-wing groups and white nationalists could be emboldened by the deadly breach of Congress by supporters of Donald Trump on the 6th of January.
Washington, D.C., the U.S. capital city, preparing for the inauguration of the next president on January 20th. However, what is most noticeable across the city is heightened security. Roads around the White House are blocked. Many public areas and businesses closed off until after the inauguration. Capitol Hill is being guarded by police, National Guards, and other law enforcement officers. In order to move between the White House and the Congress building, citizens need to pass through strict security checks. Officials are even pushing for more security.
We have a special responsibility that there is a peaceful transition of power in our country. We're proud in Washington to host the federal government, and we want to make sure that that event is peaceful.
Tensions are running high in light of the January 6th seizure of the Capitol building by supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump. Earlier this week, the House of Representatives impeached Trump for inciting what it called the insurrection that left five people dead. A police officer was among those killed. U.S. intelligence reports gathered from social media platforms suggest that authorities are tracking thousands of new threats against politicians ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration ceremony. These threats include calls for the assassination of Democrat lawmakers, usage of explosives and weaponry, and million militia marches. Former FBI Director James Comey has also warned of a very serious risk of violence during Biden's inauguration. D.C. citizens are very concerned, too.
It's the biggest security threat, internal domestic security threat, we've ever had since our Civil War. Of course, I think that that is a huge security threat.
More than 25,000 National Guards have been deployed to Washington, D.C. The Pentagon says they are authorized to carry weapons and make arrests to provide security. Other American state capitals are on alert, too. Trump's final days in office are also marked with political tensions in different layers of the U.S. government. The Senate is clashing over his impeachment trial. The House is calling for the prosecution of the lawmakers accused of helping in the Capitol Hill unrest. That comes as Vice President Mike Pence is trying to fulfill Trump's duties. Trump has even refused to participate in the inauguration of his successor, Biden. All these make the swearing-in of the 46th president of the U.S. a ceremony like no other in the American history.
President Donald Trump is reportedly planning to issue 100 pardons and commutations on his last full day in office on Tuesday. A source familiar with the case has told the CNN that Trump, at this point, is not going to issue a pardon for himself. The source says that some administration officials have cautioned the president against a self-pardon because it would make him look guilty. Trump also does not plan to issue preemptive pardons for members of his family. The outgoing president has already issued two waves of pardons in the past month. It's news review time. Welcome to the news review. Russian foreign minister has dismissed Western countries' criticism over the detention of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Sergei Lavrov says that such moves by Western states are designed to distract their people from their own domestic problems. On Sunday, Navalny was detained at an airport in Moscow upon arrival from Germany. Authorities said the arrest was made over his violation of terms of probation related to a fraud case. Last August, Navalny fell ill during a domestic flight. He was transported to Berlin, where he was hospitalized with alleged poisoning. His aides blamed Moscow for the incident, saying that Russian agents poisoned Navalny. The Russian government denied any involvement. Now let me invite a couple of guests and see what's going on there and get some insight on that. Marina Kortanova, our own correspondent, will join us from Moscow. And Fred Ware, journalist and commentator, also from Moscow. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Marina. Marina, tell us more about the Russian side of the story and the stance and the reaction that they have made regarding this criticism coming again from the Western side, and it's not the first time we know that.
Good afternoon, first of all. There's only one reaction followed by now. It's our foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. So he said that the latest statements by Western politicians on the return of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny to Moscow seek to distract their populations from the deep crisis that their countries are currently mired in. So as you know, now we have Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov a press conference. It's still going on. The press conference on the outcomes of the Russian diplomacy in the previous year. So he said that, let me quote, we saw how they latched onto yesterday's news of Navalny's return to Russia, and you can feel how glad they are to copy the same statements. They are glad because it seems that this makes Western politicians think that in this way they can distract from the deepest crisis that the liberal model of development finds itself in, he said. The Russian minister is convinced that we should not look for external reasons to justify our own actions or to divert attention from our own problems and crises, but on the contrary, we should play honestly and look for opportunities to solve our internal problems in honest, equal international cooperation. So, as you know, tens of thousands watched yesterday alternative channels in social networks how Alexei Navalny, who is under suspended sentence, was detained by officers of the search section of the Moscow Department of the Federal Penitentiary Service Penitentiary service at the Sheremetyevo airport, and he has been on the wanted list since December 29 for repeated violations of the probation term, and further measures of restraint will be determined by the court, and Navalny will be in custody until a court ruling. So before the arrest, Alexei Navalny said in the plane in Germany that he was not afraid of detention. He said that it was his choice to return or not to return to Russia, and this question did not arise for a single second. But it shows how to fight here, means in Russia.
I think we have enough of that. Okay, thank you very much, Marina. Let me turn to Fred and ask him this question. Fred, this is what the Russian foreign minister has said, that the Western states are doing this because they want to distract their people from their own domestic problems. Do you agree with that? And you know, anytime any news about we have about this opposition figure Navalny, the Western states jump at the chance and start blaming Russia. What's all this fuss about?
You know, the pot and kettle thing doesn't interest me. I'm a journalist, a correspondent stationed in Russia. I report Russian news, and there is no question that the Navalny story is an important one. There's several remarkable things about this, and one is the extraordinary fear that the government appears to have of this man. There is no sign that he has mass popular following or that he poses any kind of a political threat to the established government in Russia today, and yet they if you just see the way they behaved yesterday, changing the airports, arresting him at passport control, and so on, it signals something wrong in the Russian state of affairs, that Russia is still not a normal country. It's also not the Soviet Union anymore, because as your correspondent said, millions of Russians watched all these events unfolding on alternative TV channels like Dozhd. He did come back. In Soviet times, people did not come back. And the fear was real, but Navalny's supporters show no fear at all, as Navalny himself didn't. So Russia is not the Soviet Union, and yet somehow this whole episode, that from the poisoning, all of the things that have happened since, and his bizarre return, all these things are news about Russia. They deserve to be discussed and analyzed by people who are interested in Russia.
Fred, tell us why the Western states are so meticulous about this. What does it have to do with them?
Yes, there's some truth in what Lavrov said. It's always pleasant to deliver bad news or something about your opponent, and Russian media does that about the United States all the time. So, and Russian government criticizes the United States. This is the pot and kettle thing I referred to. It's been going on since time immemorial, and it will go on. It's not the interesting part of this subject.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. We had Marina Kartunova, our correspondent, and also Fred Ware, journalist and commentator, both joining us from Moscow with their contribution.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the VIRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program covers the entire political, economic, and social infrastructure of a region which holds almost 25% of the global population. We will try to explain these issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will talk about how Pakistan is enduring the pressure to normalize relations with Israel.
Following a U.S.-backed deal for Arab-Israeli normalization, Washington and its allies are stepping up their efforts to force more and more countries to establish relations with the Israeli regime. Recent media reports suggest that the pressure is getting higher on Pakistan as two of its important trade partners, namely the Saudi Arabian Kingdom and the UAE, are exhausting their options to push Islamabad towards relations with Israel.
Pakistan is purportedly under pressure by the UAE and Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel. The authorities in the country, however, say Islamabad never recognizes Israel until the Palestinian issue is resolved. Pakistan says it has made it clear to the UAE that Islamabad cannot recognize Israel until the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is resolved, with Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi saying that Pakistan will not and cannot establish a relationship with Israel until a concrete and permanent solution to the Palestine issue is found. Qureshi rebuffed reports that Pakistan is under pressure, adding that Prime Minister Imran Khan had time and again clarified, "There is no pressure on us in this regard." However, Khan revealed last month that Pakistan, like Sudan, was being pressed by some friendly nations to recognize Israel. Many believe the Pakistani leader was referring to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Khan insisted that Islamabad will not open up relations with the Zionists. Khan told local media that Israel's deep influence in the U.S. was behind the pressure, noting that this influence was in fact extraordinary during the Trump stint.
The UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco recently established diplomatic and economic relations with the Israeli regime, and last month, Sudan became the latest Arab or Islamic country to follow suit after heavy pressure from Abu Dhabi and Washington. Now there are reports that suggest some other countries in the region, including Saudi Arabia, are also weighing the options to normalize ties. Following the normalization decision of earlier countries, there were protests all around the world as people felt betrayed by these countries claiming themselves to be the leaders of the Muslim Ummah.
Pakistan's economy is heavily dependent on the Persian Gulf countries, and the United Arab Emirates is the country's second largest source of foreign remittance. In the last 5 years, 1.3 million Pakistanis have found jobs in the Arab country. In 2019 alone, Pakistani expatriates in UAE sent more than $5 billion back home. Now imagine the pressure when the UAE stopped issuing new visas for Pakistanis, along with the citizens of several other mostly Muslim countries. Abu Dhabi says the restrictions are due to the coronavirus pandemic, but India has more COVID-19 cases per capita than Pakistan, but no ban was imposed on visas for Indian nationals. Before the visa ban, Pakistanis sent a monthly average of $500 million back home from UAE. At this rate, Pakistan could have received foreign remittance of over $6 billion from UAE in fiscal year 2020 to 2021. Therefore, the UAE move, which is believed to be orchestrated by Saudi Arabia, would dry up this huge source of financial support. These figures are significant for the country's economy because the total foreign exchange reserves of the country stand at about $20 billion.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are joined by Mr. Sayyed Maaz Shah, who's the director for Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University in Karachi, Pakistan. Mr. Shah, thank you so much for coming back to our show. So I'll start off by asking, who or what is pressurizing Pakistan towards relations with Israel? How and why?
Interestingly, though there may be many interest groups, there is a sense of a narrative driver that's pushing this towards an end. We know of Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who've gone on a rapid, aggressive campaign in the Middle East of recent to recognize the state of Israel. I do feel that economics plays a huge role in pressuring these countries who have recognized Israel and who are being pressured to do so. This is one of the pressing points. But the purpose is very clear. The purpose is clear is to legitimize the state of Israel. And, you know, it's not only the legitimization of the state of Israel, but the legitimization of the occupied lands that have gone on over the years since 1967. We know the wall and the additional Jewish settlements. And, you know, it only begs the question is that if someone recognizes Israel today, are they recognizing their occupation in those lands? And so these are questions that I think, you know, that Israel, obviously their tactic is to isolate the Palestinians. That is the purpose. And they're using economics, particularly in this dire economic situation across the world.
Okay, so U.S. is trying to take the advantage of economic vulnerabilities in countries. Will the economic or political pressure break Islamabad's resistance against the normalization of ties with Israel?
Honestly, I don't think it'll come to that. I am being optimistic, but I think that's fairly provided by proof, because the Pakistani public are known to have a strong Islamic inclination. And there have been independent research polls that have continuously indicated this, that Pakistan has a strong Islamic sentiment. Al-Quds being the third most holiest site for a typical Pakistani cannot be compromised for some economic benefit. So, and it would be political suicide for any political leader or political party to even indicate that they have some sort of policy or even some sort of legitimization for the state of Israel. So when you look at the different political groupings, you have the nationalists, you have the Islamists, and you have the secular group. You have the nationalists and the Islamist groups that are very much against it, which is majority of the country. It's only a minority within the secular group. You have some elements who are teasing this issue through social media and other channels. And I think what's quite interesting is that a lot of uneducated youth sometimes pick up this on social media and ask these questions, that why shouldn't we recognize the state of Israel? And I think one of the main reasons is the lack of education about what's happened to the Palestinian people since 1948. And because they're Generation X and they're removed from these events, there's been a sense of lack of knowledge in respect to what that is. But not only that, a few days ago in Pakistan, we had the anniversary of a famous UN resolution in January 5th, 1949, that recognized the self-determination rights of the Kashmiri people. And Pakistan, particularly Prime Minister Imran Khan, has fielded this, you know, in a very reasonable manner, that any compromise with Israel would actually weaken the cause for the Kashmiris, as that is a legitimate cause as well. So we find that this is something that that cannot be compromised, or the Kashmiri cause will also be hurt. And there is that position as well, that is an added reasoning on top of that. And recently, Imran Khan also quoted Qaid Azam, who is a very cross figure that a lot of different groups acknowledge as the founding father of Pakistan and highly respect. He made the position very clear that whatever any country does, our position is very clear, that until Israel accepts the Palestinians and provides them with their rights, there will, and there is no just settlement, there can be no recognition for the state of Israel. And that, I think, is the final position of the Pakistani political establishment for the most part, and also the Pakistani public.
Thank you so much, Mr. Shah, for bringing that point. Let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
This tweet is about the reaction of the government and the people of Pakistan disapproving the recent normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel. Citing remarks by Israeli Minister of Regional Cooperation Ofir Akunis that Pakistan is not one of the countries that will establish normal relations with Israel in the near future, Nasreddin Kion praised Pakistani officials. Adam Weinstein points out that one of the reasons that the normalization of Pakistan-Israel relations is not formed is the existence of democracy in Pakistan despite its imperfections. Also, the author notes that if the Pakistanis recognize Israel as a state, then they should also reconsider the Kashmir issue. In that case, the Pakistanis lose the moral standings. Mentioning some reasons such as Pakistan's opposition to Israel's inclusion into the UN and also the Constituent Assembly's resolution to not recognize Israel, Ghazi Naqvi believes that Pakistan will not recognize the Israeli regime as a state.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Gas-strapped Pakistan relies heavily on Saudi Arabia and the UAE to stave off a debt crisis that is always on the horizon as foreign reserves dwindle and the economy contracts. The situation is especially bad right now as Saudi Arabia has asked Pakistan to return the loan. To decrease their leverage on the politics of the country, the Pakistani government has recently asked China for money to return a $1 billion loan to the Saudis.
Late in December, Pakistan reached out to China to return $1 billion to Saudi Arabia as a second installment of a $3 billion soft loan. Islamabad asked Beijing for the commercial loan to help it offset pressure to repay another $1 billion to Riyadh for the next installment. Analysts say it is unusual for Riyadh to press for the return of money as Riyadh had historically never asked Pakistan to repay its loans. Saudi Arabia started pushing Pakistan to repay the loan ostensibly after Islamabad sought Riyadh support over alleged human rights violations by India in the disputed territory of Kashmir. Saudi Arabia gave Pakistan a $3 billion loan and a $3.2 billion oil credit facility in late 2018. With the $1 billion flowing out, Pakistan, which has $13.3 billion in central bank foreign reserves, could face a balance of payments issue after clearing the next Saudi installment. China has come to our rescue, a Pakistani foreign ministry official told Reuters. China bailed out Pakistan by enhancing the size of a bilateral currency swap agreement by 10 billion yuan, or about $1.5 billion. Islamabad has been using the facility since 2011 to repay foreign debt and keep its foreign currency reserves at manageable levels.
Measures by Saudi Arabia and UAE have worsened the situation for Pakistan that was already in a precarious economic condition due to the suspension of its bailout program by the International Monetary Fund, as well as the damage caused by the coronavirus pandemic. However, Saudi Arabia and UAE did not seem content with their plans to choke Pakistan economically and resorted to the other methods which exerted more pressure on Pakistan.
The United Arab Emirates is a country mainly run and populated by expatriates, and Pakistanis are nearly one-third of the population, second only to Indians. Nevertheless, Emirates has a long history of human rights violations and discriminations against the expats, particularly Pakistanis. The UAE has been consistently under the criticism for its vague laws, oversized police powers, forced disappearance and detention without charge against ordinary citizens and expats. However, the systematic targeting of Shia Muslims in the country has especially increased after the deal with Israel. Since Abu Dhabi normalized ties with the Israeli regime, the internet is increasingly rife with stories of forced disappearances blamed on the government. Many people have been detained by the state without any proper legal procedure, while nobody knows about their whereabouts. The victims are out of the protection of law because the authorities deny they are being held.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's talk to Ms. Narjis Zehra Habib, whose father, Mohammed Habib, is one of those Pakistani nationals who went missing in the UAE back in October last year. Ms. Habib, welcome to the program. Please tell us about the case of your father and whatever information you have so far about what happened to him.
My dad's name is Mohammed Habib. He has been working in the UAE, in Dubai specifically, for the past 40 years in the foreign exchange industry. On October 21st, 2020, in midday, four men in civil dress came in his office, and they first closed the security cameras, and then they took his mobile phones, and then they asked him to accompany him to the van, which was some distance away. Since then, we have not heard or seen our father. It's been almost 80 days. My aunts are actually Arab nationals. They got married into Arabs. So they have been trying really hard. They've been going to different departments, different police stations, just in order to file the FIR. Initially, for a good month, they refused to even do that. After a month, after my aunts continuously trying to get any official word through, they did lodge an FIR, but then nothing has been followed up since. They always say that, oh, you have to wait for the call, you have to wait for the call, but then that never comes. We were hoping that we'd hear back soon after the New Year, since that's such a hyped up time in the UAE. But then nothing so far either.
Ms. Zehra, I'm very sorry, and indeed that is very sad and extremely disappointing. So have you been given any information whatsoever on whether there are any charges against him or about his whereabouts?
So it's been almost 80 days and we haven't heard back at all. We haven't heard from him, we haven't seen him since. At this point, we're so frustrated that what we want is that if there is even a tiniest thing or the most insignificant thing that they have against my father, they should rather communicate at this point than just keeping him over there. And if not, then it's an extreme form of human rights violation, which for, by the way, we have contacted multiple really big names of human rights organizations. We've been in contact with Amnesty, with HRF, with Human Rights Watch. All they've done so far is just take up the story, and then there's been no follow-up from their end either. So at this point, our entire family, our entire community is frustrated with the international organization as well as the UAE government, that it's such a huge thing. There have been multiple people missing for the past almost 3 months, and no contact, no update, no whereabouts about their health, about where they are, have been communicated to their families. We don't know when will they get back to us through the families.
Let's just take a quick look at how the global media has covered this issue.
It's been 3 weeks since Hussein, a resident of the UAE for the past 40 years, was arrested in his Deira workplace without any explanations or warrants provided. Hussein's peculiar arrest is not surprising, as a crackdown targeting Pakistani immigrants, a majority of them Shia Muslims, is currently going on in the UAE. Ever since the UAE secured the normalization deal with Israel back in September, the crackdown on the members of the diaspora community has been aggravating. UAE begins subjecting Pakistani Shia Muslims to enforced disappearance in what appeared to punish Pakistani nation for opposing normalizing relations with Israel. First, United Arab Emirates victimized Pakistani Shia Muslim expatriates in the UAE. Now, the sheikhdom has also begun targeting non-Shia Pakistani expatriates.
For more analysis on this, we are joined by Mr. Musharraf Husseini, who's a political analyst. Mr. Husseini, welcome to the show. So, how do you relate the UAE-Israel normalization with the systematic targeting of Pakistanis in the country?
I don't accept it as a normalization. This is like submission to Israel. With Israel keep on doing whatever they have been doing for years against the Palestinians and the cause of the Palestinians, and brush aside everything and just say that we accept Israel. Israel accepting Israel in this normalization in the present situation means we accept Israel with all its atrocities against what it is doing and it has been doing against the Muslim population and the Palestinians and otherwise for centuries, from Sabra, Shatila, onward towards what has been happening in Gaza, in West Bank, and otherwise, and whatever the atrocities they have been committing, and with children in jails, with the women in jail, against the people born in the camps in the Palestinian population, and they've grown up in the camps and they got old in the camps. We are accepting everything as a norm of as a normal life for them, and we are signing on that Israel, whatever it is doing, we accept them like that. So it is not a normalization. So the Arab country thought that if they submit to Israel and they normalize their relationship with Israel, they accept Israel, and the Pakistan don't, so it will be a big problem for them. And there might be a backlash in other Muslim countries too. So they wanted to pressurize Pakistan to submit to their will and accept Israel also. So it was a tactic from them to emotionally blackmail the Pakistan government and to put that population into trouble. And what they did, what I got the report that some families were taken away and they didn't know where about the families didn't know about the people who were taken away, about their whereabouts. And some people who are given visa to enter and for the jobs in Emirates, when they arrived at the airport, they were picked up and they were taken away straight away. They were taken into the custody. I can't understand that when you have given them the visa and they have arrived there, and not only those people who arrived there, they were taken away and they were taken to unknown places. But the people who have come to the airport to receive them, when they contacted the authorities to find out the whereabouts, they were also taken into custody, and their whereabouts were not known. And later on, there were some families and their women also, and the families who were taken away. It was like an indirect pressure for that problem, so that convey to the Pakistan government that if you don't accept our demand, the only thing that we are going to do is send your labor population, and we create problem from them. And these people who have been sending the foreign exchange to our country, which is very much required in this present juncture, when the PTI government, the Prime Minister Imran Khan, is striving and struggling to bring Pakistani government out of the situation, the economic troubles, and it's on the brink of bringing them out. So an additional trouble from the United Arab Emirates can pressurize the Pakistani government. But a Pakistani government has decided that it will take no pressures. It will make the rightful decision what they have to take, and they will stand by the Muslim population of the Palestine, and they will not let the Palestine Palestinian population being betrayed by the big countries and the wealthy countries of the Muslim world.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode about Pakistan and the possibility of normalization of relations between Pakistan and the Israeli regime. We'll meet next week.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
This type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd As-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and another program for humanity where we are discussing Imam Ali al-Sajjad's Treatise of Rights. We're talking about haqqul khaliyat, the rights of the person who you are mixing with. And we explain that it is broader than your associate, broader than your friend. And we are speaking about deception and lying. And it's one of the qualities that really, really destroy us. It's a trait that will kind of bring about the worst in us. And that's exactly why it's a kind of hypocrisy. And Islam has made it very clear how hypocrisy is dangerous and damaging and how evil it is. Because the reality is that a hypocrite is someone who's just covering something that is hidden. They're revealing something else. And that's the worst form of deception. Even in the Holy Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, إِنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهِ. The hypocrites, they are deceiving God, or they're trying to deceive God, but they're only deceiving themselves, as the Almighty says.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin. Ya Rabbi salli ala Muhammadin wa Ali. Ya Rabbi salli ala Muhammadin wa Ali.
Another verse from the Quran, it says, إِذْ يَقُولُ الْمُنَافِقُونَ وَالَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ. The hypocrites and those who have sicknesses in their hearts. So reality is that hypocrisy is a kind of sickness, which is exactly why Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, how bad is it, how evil is it for a human being to have an internal, an inner sickness, batinan alilan, an inner sickness and seemingly outer beauty, wa zahiran jamila. So basically this is meaning that the actions don't really correspond to their real true self, and claiming something different to what it is that one really represents. Now that being said, you know, when we have a look at what it is that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi has said about ghish, where he said that whoever does any kind of deception is not from among us, the Muslim Ummah. You know, laysa minna man ghashana, which is a hadith narrated by various imams and also by the holy prophets. We're just going to go for a short break and we will be back very soon.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we're speaking about what Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam is referring to in the part where he's talking about lying and deception and avoiding these kind of traits in our interaction with other people. When we want to interact with other people, we want to make sure that we don't turn them into enemies. We're never dishonest to them, and we always try to make sure that we are the best. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, he says, condemning ghish, he says, al-ghish sharrul makr. Makr means deception. And ghish means tricking is the worst kind of deception. And these are the things that we need to really stay away from, even if we don't know that person. And we need to make sure that we remember it's the lowest and worst of traits that a person can have. And looking at it in this particular way, in it being something wicked and something wretched, a true believer is someone who avoids and stays away from these kind of traits. They won't live a happy life, they won't live a comfortable life, because they're always going to feel guilt, and they will never keep any kind of friendship. This is why the hadith says, "Man makara bin nas, radda Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala makrahu fi unuqi." Whoever deceives people, God is going to turn that deception around onto the same person. You know, the hadith says that if you dig a hole for your friend, you are going to fall into that hole. And you know, Imam As-Sajjad here, he speaks about lying as well. He says that don't lie to that person that you are interacting with. Reason being is, we know that lying is the worst of evil.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله 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 صل على محمد وآله.
All evil, if it was contained in one room, the key to that, as the hadith says from Imam Al-Askari, is lying. And a person who becomes a liar or is lied to, it's the worst thing, because one lie leads to another lie, and that leads to another lie. And when someone gets used to lying, they will never ever be able to lead it, and they won't know the boundaries for any of that anymore. And of course, when we see that Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, says these kind of issues and being dishonest and things like that, and not behaving in this kind of way that is going to break down the level of positive interaction that someone might have with other people. Until our next program, please visit us on www.parstoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.